Well, since it is the morning, Doc, I think we should just say good morning to American Christian listening out there.
It is a good morning.
It is. We're rolling up into a beautiful, I think, sunshiny afternoon.
Right.
We are episode 30. We are speaking about revival and the American Christian. And we are kind of looking at this historical run-through. We started back in with the Great Awakening. And then we went up into the Welsh for a little while, and now we're over in Korea on the other side.
Korea, man, there's a lot to learn from the Korean Christians.
There is. You know, Doc, you were mentioning a little earlier in our pre-meeting about this idea of one of the things that kind of came out of Korea was the prayer, and how we were kind of talking about that. What does that look like? I mean, do you think that it looks different everywhere as to how the Spirit's moving? Because, like you were saying, we can't manufacture. We can't go in and go, like we're putting to re-engineer, or what do they call that when they go back and they take something, they re-engineer it.
Yeah.
We can't really do that with, well, in Pyongyang, 10,000 people were coming together for prayer at 5:30, right? Like, you can't just say that that's the deal, because the Spirit is at work in that.
Right. And plus the urgency of the prayer and the soul-searching and the conviction and all of that. You can't orchestrate that stuff. You can't reproduce it, as much as we like to think we've got all our modern methods and all our modern technology and all that. There's a point which there's simply a human soul that is hungry for God.
Right.
And reaches out, and God answers and starts doing stuff.
So you were also talking about Bultmann.
I was.
Well, just a little bit there. Because...
Well, here's how I got off on Bultmann. Okay, right. How do you relate the revival in Korea to Bultmann? Well, in this little book here about the revival, they redefine biblical criticism. And of course, Rudolf Bultmann is probably one of the best known guys of the 20th century for biblical criticism. He's kind of the founder of form criticism and redaction criticism and all this stuff. And so this guy is talking about criticism. They reversed it. Instead of Christians criticizing the Bible, they let the Bible criticize them.
Ooh, yeah, right.
That's what he says. Therefore, they always let the Bible criticize them first, and they never find anything of themselves left so as to venture to criticize God's book. He says, I believe in that kind of biblical criticism. Then he says, if men were all humble enough to approach the Bible in the Korean spirit, there would be more books burned around some seminaries than were ever burned on the streets of Ephesus when Paul preached there.
Yeah, we kind of think of book burning as being a 20th century thing, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the thing with Bultmann, he was kind of a leader out in the whole area of saying, well, we know there's no such thing as an angel or a demon. I mean, we live in the 20th century, dude. Mm-hmm. We have planes, trains, automobiles. What is recorded from the ancient world, from the New Testament, is full of myths and legends and fables and things people believed back then. But we're smart now. We know all that stuff doesn't exist. So what we have to do is we have to take the gospel, demythologize it, and then package it for the 20th century person so they can understand it. Hey. And I'm saying he was kind of the forerunner for the whole attractional church methodology of the last 30, 40 years, which he didn't teach that directly. He was more into the demythologizing part. But really, isn't that what they do? I mean, it's like we're going to change the way we do everything to just attract people and somehow draw them in here and keep them placated. If it's a 59-minute sermon, if they want smoke, give them smoke. If they want skinny jeans, wear skinny jeans. Whatever, change everything.
culture dictated.
Right, right. And what we are seeing right now, I believe, in America is the judgment of that whole thing. I just heard this weekend about an attractional church in the Twin Cities that just opened up a week ago from the COVID. And it was practiced. I know a person who went there and said, I couldn't believe this church at its peak in the attractional times, they had like 5,000 people going there. And he said there was almost nobody there on Sunday morning. So the point of all of that is revival takes you back to the roots, to the core, to letting the Bible do the criticizing instead of you criticizing the Bible. And I know. I mean, I taught hermeneutics long enough to know, look, the Bible has to be interpreted, and hopefully correctly. But the real things of the Bible are not that complicated. Thou shalt not kill, okay? Right. Thou shalt not commit adultery. You know,
it's good for a life.
Honor thy father and mother. I mean, that's not rocket science, right?
Right. Well, I'm glad that you said that because really that kind of leads us into this, what happens in Pyongyang, why things, because we're kind of coming to a conclusion, listener, of the Korean revival.
Right.
And why does this take place? And one of the reasons why this particular revival kind of tanks out, there are not that world politics dictates what God will or will not do, but in the scheme, remember that as we kind of come out of the close of this, we have a lot of things that have happened in Korea with the churches and hospitals and things that really got picked up. A lot of things were happening there. People were being converted, being baptized, right? They start to output missionaries. So there's that going on, but really when Japan comes in and brings occupancy once again into Korea, the Japanese tell the university directors, look, you have to bring in Japanese religion in that worship of the emperor, and they refuse to do it.
Ooh.
So what is that? What do you think that could look like in the 21st century?
Well, it's already happened here. The Marxists long ago told our universities you have to teach Karl Marx, and they've been doing it now for 30, 40 years. And now you see what we have. I'm sorry, just saying. I mean,
there's a lot of other things that are being taught in our schools right now, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like the 1919 Project, 1916 Project.
Oh, my word.
I was just reading in Epoch Times, they were talking about bringing in the whole teaching on critical race theory.
Oh, my word.
Look, to think that we're not going to be up against a pushback from political or from religious or from educational systems, right, where the mind is the most important thing to get after right now.
Right.
It is.
And these revival guys understood that in forming this school, even though it didn't run real long, it was very influential in its time. But what you just said, Pete, really is the open door to take up this question. So you can't really talk about North Korea very long until you're talking about Kim Jong-un. Right. So what does Kim Jong-un have to do with revival? Now, there's a question for you, okay? Well, it turns out this revival we've been studying, it's broke out, was in 1903, the early beginnings of it.
Right.
Kim Jong-un's great-grandpa and his great-great-grandpa were both leaders in that revival.
In the Presbyterian
people at churches and things there. It was Kim's grandfather that became a Marxist and started taking up the ways of communism. And then as the revival began to tail off, and the Japanese were no longer in control of the country. And of course, that was a rallying cry, too. You could raise up the Marxists to oppose the Japanese and push them out.
Whoa, and, that I did not know.
Oh, yeah. So then communism overtakes, and of course, the Korean War that the United States was involved in very heavily. Mm-hmm. And you're into the 1950s now.
And so, we have a separation. We're coming into that separation of North and South, right? Or
right.
Does that happen a little bit later?
That, yeah, that right at the end of the Korean War. That's when that happens. So Kim Jong-un, whether you want to acknowledge it or not, is a son of revival.
Right.
He's and, just a little, he's wandered away from his roots a little bit here.
Right.
But,
so we can also then tell them, Who else is a son or a distant cousin of revival?
I don't think any of these hearers would have heard of this guy, though, that we're going to talk about.
Well, we should at least bring it into mention just for posterity.
You mean like Donald J. Trump?
Donald J. Trump.
Okay. So, Pete, how is Donald J. Trump a son of revival?
Well, that's a good question, Doc. His great aunts
on his mother's side.
His mother's side, right? They were the two women that were the ones that were praying in the Hebrides revival.
That's right.
Which is so peculiar. And then so we have that, and we have whatever fell out in America. 2016 comes along. We have this big deal. There's a big deal going on in America for the next 4 years. Mm-hmm. To dethrone Trump, but it makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
What is the spiritual implications of the sons of revival and what they carry? And not only that, Doc, as you had pointed out a couple of years ago, which was when we learned of this information that those two men met on Korean soil.
Exactly, right at the zone there.
Yeah. Dude, that is just... Like, you can't make this stuff
you
up.
You can't.
And it is for such a time as this.
And so, American Christian, when you pray for world events and for our nation, pray for Kim Jong-un to come into the destiny of his roots.
Right.
Because it's not communism.
No.
It's revival leading to Jesus.
And what man in revival or what mother or what father is not praying for their sons and daughters and their grandchildren and their children's children? Do you understand? Because I think, listener, that you've been praying over your family, and I think that you do push into the generations. We just do it.
Yeah.
Because it is, I think, that's the Spirit pushing us into, look, you need to walk out the destiny that the Father has for you and for your generation.
And when you pray for Donald Trump, similarly, pray that the Lord will bring him into the fullness of his destiny. Apparently, there's more for him than just being president of the United States for one term.
Right.
I mean, there's a spiritual destiny on that man's life, just as there is on Kim Jong-un.
And we could even say, just as there is for you, and yes, just as there is for me.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. So that leads us, Pete, right to, so we're in the 1950s now.
Right.
The division of Korea into North and South.
Right.
And not long after that, this young man who's dying of tuberculosis gets healed and saved. Paul Yonggi Cho, he's called then. He's changed his name now to David Cho, but that was his name. And that man had a destiny on his life to lead the whole South Korean Christian movement to a level that people couldn't even imagine.
So what kind of a background does Cho come out of?
He was a Buddhist. And God looked at him and said, hey, that's my guy right there. But he's dying. He's almost dead. That's okay. We'll raise him from the dead. No, he wasn't dead yet, but he was healed from a near-death encounter with that disease. So So he starts having this vision for how church should be. And this is what I really like about him. And it's a different kind of revival. So he says, well, church should really be based in prayer. So the church finally gets to this place. They buy this mountain, and they call it Prayer Mountain. And they make all these catacombs and these caves and all these hollowed out areas where people can just, they crawl in there. Sometimes for days, sometimes for hours, they just pray and fast and seek God.
And out of Prayer Mountain, right, so here we have all these people. This is kind of to substantiate our earlier, when we introduced this episode. Even though you have this going on in Cho's world, and he sees this and it's happening, revival doesn't break out in the sense of what we have been studying in...
Right
in the Welsh or in the First Great Awakenings. That's not happening here.
This happens both in his church and also in especially Methodist and Presbyterian churches across South Korea. And his church just all of a sudden really starts growing. And that is not by church growth methods so much, but simply... He did use cell groups very much, so that the whole church was founded on a nuclear group, and then there became to be hundreds of them. And the amazing thing about this church, I visited there in Seoul in the year 2000 when we were first starting Heart of the Father Ministries. I was invited in there to be a speaker at a conference with a bunch of Presbyterian church leaders. This wasn't at Cho's church. This was at a different church. And I'm telling you, it boggled my mind. The first meeting, we went in there, and the leaders kind of warned me about this. First of all, I lost my luggage on the flight. That's a long story. So I'm in Korea with no luggage. Okay, so they take me to the hotel and they say, hey, you have to preach tonight. We take you to clothing shop. Now, the Korean people are small of stature, okay? So they take me in this shop and this young lady looks at me and they tell her, we need a shirt and pants for this man. She goes, big one. And she said, we have nothing here like that, but stay here. We have a friend. So we sit down in chairs, and they send a guy to get me a white plaid shirt and a pair of pants. And it fit me. So it was cool. You know. So I had clothes to preach in that night. But we got there. And when you step into these churches that are, I mean, they don't advertise that they're in revival. They're just, we would call it, they're in continuous revival. When they stand up to pray, a roar, a volume of sound like a waterfall just starts.
Yeah.
And there's only one way to get them to stop, or two ways. There's two ways. One is the pulpit bell. It's a little bell, not little, it's kind of a big size bell on the pulpit with a hammer on the side of it. And the pastor, when he wants to have the service move on, he gets up there and hammers on that thing with his fist. And they hear it, and they slowly, the sound starts going down. Mm. Or he has the sound guy crank the PA system up so loud that he gets on the mic that he can actually...
Make himself known.
Make himself heard, right?
Yeah.
Right. And I'll tell you another thing about that conference. It was 400 Presbyterian church leaders, pastors and deacons and elders and all that. The requirement for me as the speaker was not only to speak every night, every morning, and so forth for all those days, but I also had to prophesy over each person. And they had a box, this huge box of cassette tapes at that time, and the translator, the interpreter, had a little cassette recorder. He recorded each prophecy that I prayed and gave over each person, 400 of them. We took them in shifts. But it was a remarkable time. And to tie that back then to Pastor Choll, we did get to visit his church on one of the days. And, you know, people talk about church growth. We've had a church growth movement here in America and all that. But here was a place where true church growth was happening, meaning not taking people from this church over here on 2nd Street and transferring them over to this one on 20th Street.
Right.
That's what we call church growth in the United States. You get a better show going over here and people will come. You get a better program for the families. You get a better worship band. You get a better whatever. And then they'll come over here from... And that is not church growth. That's transferring people from one sheep shed to another.
Right. And I think that, you know, we've been in the church long enough to see some evidences. Not that it's all bad, but I would say, Christian, beware when we start to introduce that our children's programs are led by, you know, women who are teachers instead of being led by mothers who have children within the church, right? Like we're setting things up, and it's not that it's always ill,
right?
And that it's like, ooh, that's evil. No, but when you start to do that, and you start bringing in a better brew of coffee, and you start bringing in donuts, and then we change, like you're saying, they'll change the way that we're dressing. We start to loosen up the gospel message.
Yes, sir.
We don't talk about the blood, the fountain of blood. We don't sing.
How about hell? Do we talk about hell?
You do not talk about hell.
What about heaven?
Well...
A little bit.
Well, you only, you know, in a closing prayer.
Okay.
Yeah, that heaven gets open.
So at Pastor Cho's church, so this is what's happening now. This is through the 60s, into the 70s, into the 80s. First of all, to be a member.
There you go.
You have to have led one person to Jesus. You have to be baptized in water.
What?
And then you can be a member.
Right.
Okay.
What does membership do for a church, do you think?
Well, over there, it's a big deal because you really belong. But your first membership is not so much to the larger body of the church, which I believe at the time I was there, it was 700,000 people considered that their church home and were members. These are people who have led someone to Jesus and have been baptized in water, probably baptized in the Spirit, too. But think about this, American Christian. The church building where Pastor Cho had his church could seat 11,000 people.
My goodness.
That was the size of the building. It's 11,000 seats, okay? So on Sunday, they have 10 services. And with 10 services, they can only minister to 110,000 people. The congregation is 700,000.
So they have to have church every day of the week?
No, they only have it on Sundays. And they have it. And I was told when to shift for the people going out and the people coming in, you know, the service that's over and the service is coming in, they do that in 5 minutes. And they have organization, and you don't get in the wrong aisle, or you're just carried along by the train, like, you know, like catching your foot on the bumper of a car. Here you go.
Out you go.
Right.
Yeah, that is that's a kind of a big deal when you think about the administrative aspect of the church body, right? Like, if we take a look at the gifts of the Spirit, how many? Where does all this have to come together, right?
Well, and Pastor Cho himself, the administrative gifts in that man, he had like 200 staff pastors under him.
Right.
Just to even be able to keep things going, that number of people. But they weren't in it for the numbers. That's the beautiful thing about it. It just kept so growing as people just kept at the organic level, at the street level, just kept winning people. And then they won people, and then they won people, and pretty soon you got a cell group, and then the cell group is too big, so it's got to divide in two, just like healthy cells do in a body. That was really their whole principle.
So do you think that America or the Americas or the 21st century church, you think that there is going to be a move back into these kind of cell groups, home churches, and
maybe home churches? See, Pete, cell groups have been tried in America a number of times.
Do tell.
And the problem with the United States of America, now Southern America, like Central America and South America, it works well down there. They are used to dictators running their governments. They are used to being told what to do, and they do it. Mm. We are of much more independent kind of spirit in the United States of America. And trying to get Americans into cell groups is kind of like herding cats. Do you ever take a herd of cats anywhere to do something?
I have not.
No, I haven't either. Nobody has, because you can't do it.
It can't be done.
Right. And so it's possible that God could do a miracle. But I think house churches are way more likely, and I think that's a good point. I think that actually has already started to an extent in America.
Well, there's been inklings of it, yeah.
Right.
I've heard some of it. We've tried some of it even at our own house.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a attitude of, why are we doing this? You know, for the way that we were doing ours, it was a way to come together. You bring your whole family. You don't leave kids behind. Everybody comes into one place. We share a meal together. We have something to share out of the Word of God.
Mm-hmm.
We worship together, one or two songs, and then we break bread together and have communion with one another. And so we were doing that once a month, just as something
good.
To supplement, right?
Right.
But it really helped us to build, I think, that when we start looking at relationship. Relationships,
right.
You just don't lead somebody to Jesus and then go punch the clock.
Right.
You know what I mean? And bring them into church and let them go. I mean, people are led to Christ really through relationship,
right.
Aren't they?
Right, right. So really, there's several things, I think, to wrap this up, this whole Korea segment we've been on. There's a couple of things that the Korean revival and the Korean Christians can really teach us. And I don't know really in the United States if we're even willing to learn them, to be honest with you. I hope we are. But once again, it all starts with prayer.
Right.
And there is a prayer that you and I can do every day, and there is a prayer that you can only do when the Holy Spirit comes upon you and you pray from heaven. I mean, I don't know how else to explain it. It's and what, that's the prayer that God both orchestrates and hears and answers.
Right.
And that's when thousands of people come under conviction, when revival, as we're defining it here, breaks out. But the interesting thing, too, with Korea is, even though the country divided into two, and even though the communists took over, it was just the most brutal oppression on earth, it's known, it's North Korea, still is to this day, the revival kept going. And God found a man in Pastor Cho, and many others, lesser known than he, until South Korea actually was for a long time was being known as a Christian nation. So the point is, this prayer that heaven must answer is the one we've got to pray. And if you're hungry, Christian, you can pray and ask God. You can pour out your soul to Him in the secret place, in the quiet place, and then you can get together with groups of people and do it. But waiting on the Holy Spirit, waiting on the move of God, waiting for Him to come, rather than orchestrating something, is really one of the great lessons of the Korean Revival.